On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training for CORE-H, Overview of Issues, Status, and Remedial Options. Today's training was developed by the ITRC CORE-H team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Roxboro, North Carolina. I'll serve as a moderator on today's training, cover some introductory material in the first few slides, and then quickly turn the presentation over to our instructors. As we go through the presentation, each of you in the audience is in control of which slide you're on. The slide number is in the upper left-hand corner, and the instructors will say that slide number. If you're using the Clearin system, the series of orange buttons along the top allow you to navigate. The double left button brings you back to slide one. The single left button takes you back one slide. The third button is what you'll use most often. It's the single right arrow that will move you forward one slide at a time through the presentation. The double right fast forwards you to the last slide of the presentation. The house button takes you back to that presentation overview page where we started today. The question mark button is there primarily for our simulcast audience. Our simulcast audience is hearing the sound of today's training through their computer speakers. So if you're in the simulcast audience and you have a question, select that question mark button, type in your question. I'll receive that as a moderator, and I'll get to as many as we can during the question and answer breaks. If you're in the phone line, you're welcome to ask your own questions, but we do ask that you wait until the designated question and answer breaks. We'll have one in the middle and another at the end of the training. Anyone is welcome to use that question mark button at any time during today's presentation to send in a question or a comment. Today's training is based on the CORE-H Overview of Issues, Status, and Remedial Options document. Today's training is an introduction to this document, and we encourage you to download the document itself, and we'll take you to a link at the end that will allow you to do that. In addition, the presentation is available to download. You'll see information on the slides during the training class. In the downloaded versions, more information is available in the speaker's notes section. Today's training is co-sponsored by the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. They host the CLUIN website that we're using
Michael.
Today. So we are picking up some background noise, so please double check to be sure that your phone is on mute. In today's training, we're going to explain why perchlorate is a hot topic in the environmental community today, including information on sources, occurrences, toxicity and exposure, regulatory status, and remediation alternatives. If you move to slide two, using that orange right arrow button, I'm going to talk very briefly about ITRC. Overall, ITRC is a network led by state regulators, includes others in the environmental community. This diverse group works together on projects. Often the outcome of a project is a technical and regulatory guidance document and associated internet-based training. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States and includes state members from all U.S. states now, as shown on the map. Federal partners include Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency. Members of industry participate in ITRC through the ITRC Industry Affiliates Program. For more information about ITRC, I've included the website at the top of slide two. I do encourage you to go to that website. Membership is currently open for the year, so there may be ITRC teams that you're interested in joining. ITRC has a wide variety of resources available, so you can look at the guidance document page, the internet-based training page, to find information that you can use. On slide three, this is our disclaimer and copyright that we include in all training slides, training presentations. We ask you please read over this slide. In short, it says we tried to provide accurate and reliable information, but do not warranty this material. We recommend you check with local, state, federal laws, as well as experts. ITRC does not endorse any specific products. Also, ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted, so please ask permission before using. On slide four, we have a list of our course topics planned for 2008. Also, on the ITRC website under internet-based training, we have many of the actual classes scheduled. So you can look over this list and see what other classes you are interested in. On slide five, if you've joined after I got started, please review the logistical reminders on the left side of this slide. In today's presentation, we're going to start with an introduction to CORE-H, talk about sources and use, analytical methodologies, and toxicity, exposure, and risk. About halfway through, we're going to take a break for questions, and we do ask that you hold all of the questions to that question and answer break. In the second half, we're going to talk about remediation options. At the end, we'll go to some links to additional resources, and that includes the feedback form. So we do ask for your feedback, and we appreciate that information that you can provide to us. The ITRC CORE-H team is working on a new internet-based training, so any feedback that you can provide is something that we can apply right away as we develop that new training course. At the end, we'll have more time for questions and answers. On slide 6, I'll introduce our instructors for today's training class. Our instructors are members of the ITRC Kuwait team. Eric Nettle is a professor emeritus of chemical nuclear engineering at University of New Mexico. Eric developed and managed a very successful field site for in-situ treatment of nitrate-contaminated groundwater. Lee Lichtenkopf is a research scientist with the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection, Division of Science, Research, and Technology. Lee is in charge of managing the state's safe drinking water research program. Lee is also the team leader of the ITRC perchlorate team. Tony Lieberman is the bioremediation program manager and senior environmental scientist with Solutions IES in Raleigh, North Carolina. He leads his company's efforts on many industrial, brownfields, and DOD sites using biological and non-biological approaches to address complex environmental conditions. Ian Oscarby is the senior chemical engineer and innovative technology advocate for the New England District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers based in Concord, Massachusetts. He has presented papers in many conferences on subjects as diverse as thermal desorption, bioattenuation, chemical oxidation, electric resistive heating, groundwater treatment, including perchlorate treatment technologies. If you move to slide 7, I'll turn today's presentation over to Eric Nettle of the University of New Mexico. Eric?
Yes, what you will learn today, sorry for that slight delay, but welcome everybody here. We're going to talk about a number of aspects of perchlorate. First of all, what perchlorate is and why it is a contaminant of concern. It's one of the very exciting contaminants in the sense that it's relatively new, but on the other hand, a huge amount of work has been done, and a number of states have now passed MCLs. We don't have a federal one yet, but it appears to be in the work. And I'll be talking a little bit later about how the sources and uses of perchlorate relate to perchlorate contamination. And Lee will be talking about the analytical methods, Lee Lippincott. Those have been a big breakthrough in detecting perchlorate and setting MCL values, maximum concentration limits, down in the parts per billion. And today it can actually be measured in parts per trillion. So there's some interesting aspects with regard to that. And then about the toxicity risk, acceptable exposure of levels of perchlorate is important. And that seems to have stood the test of time recently. And again, Lee will be discussing that. Latest information on regulatory aspects, and that's obviously a dynamic and moving target since states are continuing to review and to change that situation. And, of course, the important aspect of remediating the perchlorate is going to be discussed in the various technologies involved and the emerging technologies that will be commercially available in the future. And where to go for more information. So if we could go then to slide 8. What is perchlorate? You'll see the molecule over there on the right-hand side with the chlorine in green and the four oxygens surrounding it and with a valency of a minus 1. And so that's the anion, and the anion structure is important because it's highly solubilized in water and acts as a very soluble salt or a conservative species, as we would call it, for transport. And it's usually found as ammonium or produced as ammonium, sodium, or potassium perchlorate, as you can see here. But it's also used and found as perchloric acid. So if we can go to slide 9. Why do we care about perchlorate? Well, in addition to the MCLs and the health issues that will be talked about later from a remediation and environmental perspective, perchlorate's very soluble, it's mobile, and interestingly enough, it's stable. It's stable in water and it's stabilized by water. Thermodynamically, it's actually unstable, but in water, it's very, very stable and persistent, as we'll talk about. Perchlorate in groundwater, then, as a consequence, or surface water, creates extensive and persistent plumes. perchlorate in groundwater has been around for a very long time, and as I get into the section on sources and uses, we'll talk about that. Literally, it's been detected in water that's thousands of years old. Perchlorate can contaminate, of course, drinking water sources. It's a human factor directly from water, but more recently, we found out that perchlorate as a salt can be taken up into vegetables, and we see our food supplies as shown here, and it presents a human health concern from both sources. We could move on then to slide 10. This is an interesting slide because we have, of course, the classical map of the United States, but what we have on here are the places where perchlorate, at least in the recent past, have been found, and you can see it covers almost the entire United States. And that's, I think, an important factor when you think about perchlorate and its forensic characteristics of where you might find it. As time is moving on, you're going to see more and more dots or symbols put on this map because more exploration and identification, if you will, or site characterization is underway for perchlorate. We can move on then to slide 11. We've touched on this a little bit, but why are we detecting perchlorate everywhere? Well, of course, that's a pretty general statement, and part of that is due to the fine development in instrumentation. The analytical instrumentation allows us to actually detect down below parts per billion to parts per trillion. And in addition, there are more natural sources than originally thought, and we could spend an hour on that topic. But you should look at the literature because it's very interesting about what's coming out of the research with regard to natural sources. It's much broader. It's apparently produced, perchlorate is produced in the atmosphere, and so the distribution is broad. However, it's concentrated, as we'll talk about later, in arid regions usually, but not always. It ends up being, as the investigations have gone on, more widely used in industry than originally thought. And as I mentioned before, we have lower detection limits. Let's move on then to slide 12, where we're going to talk about sources and uses of perchlorate. And one of the really interesting aspects of perchlorate, from an environmental point of view particularly, is it's gotten into the environment from naturally occurring sources, as you see with the deposit shown there up in the upper left-hand corner in the rock. And then, since World War II, it's been extensively manufactured for industrial and military applications. Well, why is all this important? Well, again, knowing the sources and uses guides perchlorate investigations of where you might find it. And that's certainly important from our remediation and environmental characterization perspective. So if we can go to slide 13, we're first going to talk really quickly, as an overview here, about the natural sources of perchlorate. And these have been around, obviously, for eons, but the important part is the Chilean nitrate, as illustrated in the photograph on the right, has been a source for nitrate in fertilizer and nitrate for explosives since approximately the turn of the previous centuries. So it's been imported in large quantities and then rather widely distributed throughout the agricultural regions in the United States. It also occurs in addition to the Chilean nitrate. There are vaporite deposits, and as I mentioned earlier, it's formed in the atmosphere, and so there's a lot of work that is ongoing with regard to those mechanisms and to the distribution, which is very, very interesting, of perchlorate basically as a background throughout the environment. Though you've got to remember, due to its high solubility, it's likely to concentrate in situations that are similar to arid regions. We could go on to slide 14. The big source of perchlorate really started with the man-made sources where we've manufactured it. And it was first manufactured in the early 1900s. It's an electrochemical process. And then increased dramatically in the 1940s, as will become clear in a moment as we talk about some of the applications. Again, we've touched upon this. Almost all of the manufacturing perchlorate consists of four compounds, and those that are listed there, that have cations of ammonia, sodium, potassium, and hydrogen, or perchloric acid. That has some relevance as well in terms of looking at your manufacturing processes and what those were used for. Though in water, remember that they're separated, and we have just the chloride or the perchlorate ion free to move and to migrate and associate with whichever ions are available. Let's move on to 15, slide 15, and we're going to get into some of the uses, which is a nice follow-on from the previous discussion. Perchlorate prior to World War II was used in fireworks, and I guess those have been with us for a very long time. I think that'd be an interesting study unto itself about perchlorate in fireworks. And then signal flares were used extensively in World War I. I was surprised at the number of those and the extent, but I was told that it was really very broad. But nothing in comparison to after World War II. Additional uses include oxidizing agents for solid propellants, rockets, and missiles. Well, we have some nice examples of those in the pictures over there to the right. And that's where we really started producing perchlorate in the millions and millions and millions of pounds. And it became an issue more perhaps where it's manufactured than where it's actually used as in those pictures. But certainly the manufacturing sites in general have serious amounts of perchlorate. In the case of solid propellants, large proportion by volume of U.S. production in perchlorate was used in missiles, rockets, and launch vehicles. You see the nice picture there of NASA's space shuttle, over 1 million pounds in those solid-state rockets on each side of the space shuttle, as it was lifting off. So, however, when perchlorate is in those solid-state fuels, most of it gets burned. Not all of it, always, but are consumed and broken down into oxygen. So it's a source of oxygen, basically, at high temperatures. And it's only when we have residual perchlorate that doesn't get consumed that we have, in general, an environmental problem. So don't think that it just comes or is being extruded from the back of the rockets there. It's not. Okay, and then uses of flares and munitions and pyrotechnics and grenades, all of those, what happens with perchlorate, it's an oxidant, and it gives extra energy, or the oxidizing side of any kind of chemical reaction or explosive. So commercial explosives, obviously, can use perchlorate, but not always. Fireworks, probably almost always. Flares and hazard flares, essentially always. And then we have some interesting innovative applications like car airbags. When those airbags go off, they have to go off very, very fast, and that's basically an explosion that's augmented by the oxygen supplies by the perchlorate. So, and then we put et cetera because there's still additional applications, and I think we're still discovering those with regard to commercial products. We can move on to slide 18 now. We'll continue on those some of those uses, and they get a little bit more distant in regards to applications. Matches, for example, when you strike a match, it bursts into flames. That's really the, in part, the perchlorate that's in those. But that perchlorate in matches, when they are burned, gets consumed. But if the matches are put into unconsumed, put into landfills, etc., then you have perchlorate, because it's rather highly soluble. Industrial applications are actually quite a bit more extensive than considered previously. Laboratories use perchloric acid. That's not uncommon. and that's a source. And then we mentioned previously the contamination of agricultural fertilizer, such as the imported Chilean fertilizer that's been widely distributed. And there's some recent articles on the amount that's been brought in and the distribution and the resulting potential concentrations. So there's quite a bit written in the literature, of course, about perchlorate, but also about any of these individual topics. And, of course, medical and pharmaceutical, some very interesting history to perchlorate regarding the thyroid gland and as a treatment. Water and wastewater treatment and sodium chlorate manufacturing as a side product for chlorate is produced. Again, moving on to slide 19. And, of course, what happens, and this is kind of an important slide, if you will, is how does perchlorate become releases into the environment due in part to past practices? Well, what we see is disposal, not burning of solid propellants, explosives, and munition. It can be part of it. And these occur sometimes in what I call partial burn and open detonation areas. There you don't get necessarily complete combustion, but also you get a lot of quantity of materials passing through those sites. So a little bit of perchlorate introduced frequently enough produces a lot of perchlorate to the environment. Hydraulic washout or hog out of munitions is not uncommon in the military, and there it's unreacted perchlorate that's free to, one, immediately be blended with water, and two, go into the environment. Manufacturing practices, of course, in the past they were quite different than they are today. And you have wastewater storage, which was always historically in unlined lagoons, oftentimes in permeable formations where that water went right down into the groundwater. And we have innumerable examples of that with not just perchlorate, but other material or other contaminants. Disposal and storage practices, testing, and of course landfills. And we talked a little bit about that previously. Let's move on then to slide 20. Just a bit as a recap, potential perchlorate releases can also be from fireworks. And again, some of the perchlorate gets burned, but some of it does not. Explosives, surprisingly to me anyway, not all of the perchlorate gets used for various reasons. Part of it is the explosives at blast sites don't always, all of them go off. Impurities in agriculture, sodium hyperchlorate is a byproduct we mentioned, or treatment in water and water waste, and sodium chlorate manufacturing, which we discussed before. Slide 21, let's move there. And we'll recap a little bit now with regard to the environment, fate, and transport. And some important considerations is it's released as a salt, and it was considered a salt until it was considered a contaminant. It's considered a safe salt in the past, and so it was not handled in any special way. It obviously has great movement in soils and depends on the water to transport it because it is soluble. If you don't have water, it's a powder. And groundwater perchlorate characteristics are a very, very high solubility, a very low absorption, and a surprising lack of degeneration. One would think that it should have degenerated. It does not. Plumes then result in very large coverages and surprisingly long persistence. Okay, with that, we're going to move on to Lee Lippincott's section, and that begins on slide 22. So if you wouldn't mind, let's go to slide 22, and I'll turn it over to Lee.
Thank you, Eric. There's a reason that we're finding perchlorate in more places than we expected. One has to do with the improved analytical methodologies, and you can see here on the slide that methods were developed back in 1997, and at that time, 4 parts per billion or 4 micrograms per liter was the quantitation level. Today, even this slide lists 1 part per billion. That's the control level for one of the techniques that we'll discuss later from the Massachusetts survey that was done. They had a lot of QAQC associated with method 314 from the US EPA. They were able to get down to about 1 part per billion. But today, like Eric mentioned previously, We can go down to, I think the lowest method detection limit that's reported is 0.01 part per billion, or that's 10 parts per trillion. So, as was mentioned previously by Eric, we're starting to see it just about everywhere at background levels when you get down to sub-part per billion levels for perchlorate. If we could move to slide 23, please. Now, currently available analytical methods and research analytical methods for perchlorate are listed here in this slide. Start off first with ion chromatography. Now, ion chromatography separates the ions in solution by pressurized liquid column chromatography and then detects the ions utilizing a very sensitive conductivity detector. Now, as you would suspect, I said conductivity, and that means that any dissolved ions that are in the solution other than perchlorate have the potential to affect sampling results. And you're going to see some chromatograms in later slides that show you just how exaggerated that effect is on the chromatography. Now, typically, ion chromatography uses mobile phases that are acidic or basic, and typically, they're more polar mobile phases that are used in liquid chromatographic applications. Liquid chromatography, or LC, is an analytical chromatographic technique that's useful for separating ions or molecules that are dissolved in a solvent. Now, if the sample solution is in contact with a second solid or liquid phase, the different solutes will interact with the other phase to differing degrees due to differences in absorption, ion exchange, partitioning, or size. So they're all the different types of liquid chromatography that have been developed and applied to detecting perchlorate in the environment. Now, most of the data that's been collected to date is from drinking water sources and has used the ion chromatographic technique with a conductivity detector. The newer methods that are being used and developed use a mass spectrometer or two mass spectrometers in series, and that technique's called tandem mass spectrometry. These detectors can not only quantify the amount of perchlorate present, but they can positively identify them by mass. This greatly reduces the probability of false positive reporting and false negative reporting of perchlorate from the conductometric techniques. So the tandem mass spectrometry is nothing more than the first mass spectrometer acting as a filter to improve the signal-to-noise ratio, followed by a second detection in the second mass sector of the spectrometric technique. That's where it's detected and quantified by mass. Going on to slide 24, you can see that I have two chromatograms listed here, and the ion chromatographic method that produced these is USEPA's method 314 or 314.0. And again, this method analyzes for perchlorate ion in drinking water, sensing its conductivity in solution. Now, if we look at the left ion chromatogram at the bottom of the slide in the lower right-hand corner, you can see that the baseline's not horizontal. This means that there's a significant background response by the detector, and therefore false negative reporting by the laboratory has been a concern with this method due to contributions to the signal from other conductive interfering species present in the sample. Ideally, that line that you see, rather than being at a decreasing 45-degree angle, approximate angle, should be flat. Should it be a flat baseline, but it isn't. There's also a high probability of false positive reporting for this method. If the samples that are being analyzed contain high dissolved solids or conductivity, the method can yield misleading information, as with the chromatogram on the right. If we take a look at that chromatogram, we see that there's two peaks. One is at 11.067 minutes, and it's the smaller perchlorate peak. And that's immediately followed by the 11.688 minute peak that's from a contaminant. Now, if the perchlorate was not present, the laboratory technician could misidentify the contaminant peak as perchlorate and report a false positive determination. So method 314 is not a determinative method. That means that the signal is not exclusively unique to the perchlorate molecule. To confirm the presence of perchlorate in environmental samples, it's preferable to use an analytical technique called mass spectrometry. And this has been endorsed Mass spectrometric techniques have been endorsed recently by the Department of Defense for use in characterizing a variety of their sites. And in that technique, the chemical composition of the unknown ions are detected and quantified by their mass-to-charge ratio, or their masses. Other methods that are being developed improve upon Method 314 and Chapter 3 of a perchlorate overview document, and Table 3-1 have a comparison of the laboratory methods. Now, if we move on to slide number 25, there are several methods that have been published or in development to improve upon US EPA Method 314, and the ITRC perchlorate overview document covers these developments in more details. US EPA methods that have recently been published are EPA methods 331 and 332. These two methods use the determinative mass spectrometer detector to identify and quantitate perchlorate by mass. Method 331, as you can see here, is a liquid chromatography mass spectroscopy technique, LCMS method, and 332 is an ion chromatography mass spectrometry method, ICMS. I've listed their internet addresses for you here so that you can learn more. The fully published methods are at that URL address. Going to the next slide. There are many other methods under development by several different organizations, including the EPA, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the U.S. Air Force, and the Food and Drug Administration. The information presented here includes projects that are under development in the Office of Solid Waste, like the SW 6800 series methods. As you can see, the SW methods are similar to the U.S. EPA Office of Water methods because they utilize LCMS and ICMS in single or tandem configurations. When I say tandem configurations, you'll see, for instance, SW6860 has ICMS/MS. That's the abbreviation for the tandem mass spectrometry. Okay. As I mentioned previously, both 6850 and 6860 have been selected by the DoD and are in use on several locations. One of our team members, Robert Barnwell from Alabama, is currently using those two methods on his sites in Alabama. The Food and Drug Administration methods are available for analyzing food products, and these various techniques could be used for challenging solid or aqueous matrices. So I'd recommend the use of the solid waste methods and the FDA methods because they're more robust for handling difficult matrices. If you want to get an idea of cost, we've assembled this this table on slide number 27. And as you can see at the top is US EPA Method 314. Stated detection level is 4 micrograms per liter. There was a modification to 314.1 that I'll talk about in the next slide. It gets you down to about 0.5 or 1 microgram per liter. And then as you can see, the newly implemented methods and published methods by the EPA and solid waste folks can get down sometimes to significantly lower levels than the 1 part per billion level that we talked about previously with the conductance methods. Moving on to the next slide, number 28. When you choose an analytical method that's appropriate for your site-specific needs, you want to consider the regulatory acceptance of the method, state or US EPA certification issues, if they exist. You want to choose a method that gives you adequate sensitivity so you can characterize your site and develop a good site model, conceptual site model. And in difficult situations where you might have naturally occurring or synthetic perchlorate contamination and you need to address the relative ratios between the two, you have to have selectivity, and we'll talk about a little bit about some of the isotope methods that have been used to identify whether or not you have naturally occurring perchlorate on your site. Moving to slide number 28. On this slide, we give you this hypothetical example of an analytical strategy that you might want to utilize on your site. strategy starts out with the promulgated U.S. EPA method 314, and obviously you want to use the most inexpensive method to do your initial site characterization with confirmation from your more difficult samples by the mass spectrometry technique. So if the perchlorate is detected and the method 314 results agree with the hydrogeological models, then the 314 was adequate for your particular site at characterizing and identifying where the perchlorate contamination is. Okay? If the analytical results don't agree with the projections, you can either pre-treat the sample and run again, or use a determinative method, like we mentioned previously, LCMS or ICMS, to identify and quantitate the perchlorate in your sample. An example of this method used for groundwater contamination is illustrated in Figure 3-1 in our overview document. Moving on to the next slide. Continuing with this analytical strategy, if perchlorate is not detected, the analytical results from 314 are non-detect without dilution, then 314 results are acceptable as is. But if the samples require dilution to the calibration range, then you have to determine whether a new reporting limit is acceptable. If the results still of non-detect and you have high reporting limit, then the recommendation is to analyze by one of the determinative mass spectrometric methods. Going on to the next slide. Additional techniques that you may want to consider are for your site characterization or forensic techniques. And this typically gives you the big picture view for site evaluation. Now, environmental forensics is a systematic investigation of a contaminated site or event where the focus of the investigation is on defensively allocating liability for the contamination. Some approaches for soil and groundwater include traditional source identification and concentration profiling, association with affiliated chemicals like explosives or binders that are mixed in with the perchlorate for rocket engines, or isotopic analysis like we mentioned previously for the identification of natural sources. Now, the isotopic analysis research is focusing on the ability to distinguish the naturally occurring sources from the synthetic perchlorate contamination. Detection and use of associated chemicals is often of more forensic value in identifying and allocating the source than for contaminants of concern. For example, when identifying perchlorate associated with highway road flares, you can look for the distribution of strontium nitrate, which often composes up to 70% of the road flare. Other co-contaminants may also lead a site investigator to suspect perchlorate contamination. Going to the next slide, 32. Concern for perchlorate in the environment is shown in this slide. Most of the available research on perchlorate is focused on determining effects of human exposure, but perchlorate may also have deleterious effects on other species throughout the environment, and this is the subject of ongoing research. Next slide. Number 33. We talk about routes of human exposure on this slide and the different scenarios. There's primary and secondary routes of exposure. Perchlorate is a concern not only in drinking water, but it's also been found in food. In a recent study, the FDA determined that leafy vegetables can contain as high as 12 parts per billion perchlorate. Milk can contain as much as 6 parts per billion perchlorate. And he also investigated some other food products. The results of this investigation can be found at the URL that I listed on this slide. Now, there's also additional articles that are referenced and available in our overview document, and they include one from the Journal of Agricultural Food Chemistry that described perchlorate accumulation in forage and edible vegetation. This was by the author Jackson. And just to give you an idea of how much is there in cucumbers, they found 0.77 parts per million. Cantaloupe was 1.6 part per million. And tomatoes are 0.22 milligrams per kilogram or part per million. As you can see, these part per million levels are well above the action levels that have been promulgated for drinking water sources. There was another really good article in ES&T volume 39 by Sanchez that talked about perchlorate and nitrate levels in leafy vegetables in North America. For instance, spinach has about 628 parts per billion perchlorate, baby mixed lettuce about 370 parts per billion, and green leaf lettuce about 195 parts per billion of perchlorate. So there are secondary routes of exposure that have to be considered when you do the risk evaluations. Moving to the next slide. There was an initial survey done in 2004 for perchlorate contamination across the country, and it's been documented in 35 states by the EPA. And EPA monitored for perchlorate in drinking water throughout the country under the Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule program. As of 2005, perchlorate's been detected in 153 public water systems in 25 states across the United States. The majority of the detections in drinking water have not been associated with U.S. EPA-identified perchlorate releases, and most detections that have been found have been below 12 parts per billion. California, there have been 350 wells of approximately 6,700 public drinking water sources that have been sampled containing perchlorate. It's also been found on the lower Colorado River, which is a major source of irrigation and drinking water. Sarah Piper from Nevada DEP was part of one of the team leaders previous to me on our group, and she described that in our latest that case study in Henderson in our latest tech reg document that we're about to publish, the second document in the series that talks about remediation. Texas Commission on Environmental Quality has detected perchlorate in areas exceeding 30,000 square miles in western Texas. That's interesting. Extensive testing of New Jersey and Massachusetts public water supplies has shown several drinking water sources to have perchlorate, and that testing was in addition to the testing that was required under the Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule by the U.S. EPA. Moving on to the next slide, we talk about secondary routes of exposure and they consider impacts to sensitive receptors for human developmental approach. Secondary exposure of the fetus can occur from perchlorate passed through the placenta when a mother is hypothyroid, and secondary neonatal exposure can come from human breast milk. So not only can the fetus be exposed in the mother who's has a hypothyroid condition, but it also gets transmitted through food products and human milk as well. And next slide talks about perchlorate toxicity. Perchlorate is one of several compounds that competitively interfere with iodine uptake in the thyroid. Examples of other interfering chemicals are nitrates and thiocyanates, which also inhibit iodine uptake. The risk assessment for perchlorate has been complicated by the fact that perchlorate is not a known human carcinogen. And in fact, as mentioned previously by Eric in the introduction to the presentation here, it's been used as a therapeutic agent for hyperthyroid individuals. If we take a look at the metabolic exposure responses on the next slide, slide 37, perchlorate basically dissolves in the blood and inhibits the natural uptake of iodine. Now, a normal diet contains about 400 to 500 micrograms of iodine, of which the thyroid gland takes up about 80 plus micrograms. Once dietary intake of iodine is consistently under 100 micrograms per day for a period of about 3 months, you can start to detect hypothyroidism, and it'll become more and more apparent. Now, iodine deficiency is said to be a public health problem for about 30% of the world's population. There's places, villages in Zaire where everybody's hypothyroid, and we don't know the extent of exposure due to competitive inhibitors like nitrate and thiocyanate and perchlorate. So it's difficult to isolate a specific perchlorate effect because there are other things that actually affect the uptake of iodine. I put a couple of, at the bottom of the slide, I put the chemical structure of a couple of the serum proteins T4 thyroxin and triiodothyronine T3 just to show you that iodine uptake is critical for the production of these two serum proteins because these proteins need to be produced in the blood to assist in the production of thyroid stimulating hormone in the pituitary. If you'll see at the, about the center of the slide to the right, these serum proteins participate in the production of the process of THS. Okay. Going to the next slide, 38. Reduced levels of perchlorate cause a condition doctors call hypertrophy or hyperplasia. This may lead to hypothyroidism and can have a metabolic effects in humans in every age. But its primary concern from a risk assessment perspective is for abnormal fetal and infant growth and development. Now, these effects have not been identified in humans as the result of perchlorate exposure and are difficult to estimate from animal data due to the large amount of uncertainty and extrapolation of the effective dosages from species to species. This is due to difference in the hormone physiology between humans and the animals. And metabolic sequelae, by the way, at the bottom there, just means affects the metabolic endpoint. Going to the next slide, we show some of the elements of the current human health risk assessments. There's a general agreement that fetal and neonatal neurodevelopment is primary concern for human health risk assessment. Based on available laboratory and animal studies, the most sensitive subpopulation is the developing fetus, and a mother who's hypothyroid. Other populations of concern include nursing infants, children, postmenopausal women, and hypothyroid individuals. The thyroid hormones are critical for both the fetus and the neonate. Although periods of development that are most sensitive to thyroid perturbations are known, our understanding is limited by the lack of data on perchlorate dose response. This makes it difficult to predict the potential effects of perchlorate. Some risk assessors believe that the hypothyroid pregnant women may not have sufficient compensatory mechanisms to manage and reduce iodide uptake due to perchlorate competitive inhibition. There's still uncertainty in the dose-response relationship, and human epidemiological data does not support this hypothesis. Moving to the next slide. An oral RFD, or reference dose, is an estimate to within an order of magnitude of daily oral exposure to the human population, including sensitive subgroups, that is likely to be without appreciable risk of deleterious effects during the individual's entire lifetime. Now, high-confidence RFD is based on data that addresses all potentially critical life stages. And although there is a standard process for risk assessment, its application on a site-specific basis can be complex. There's many elements that complicate a risk assessment. There's a difficulty in site characterization, the likelihood of exposure under different scenarios, and the ongoing scientific debate over the toxicity of perchlorate. This uncertainty results in a range of different outcomes and risk evaluations that we see across the country. These difficulties are evident in site-specific risk assessments for most chemicals, including perchlorate. Going to the next slide, slide 41. Now, the National Academy of Sciences and the National Research Council Committee reviewed existing studies for perchlorate. Their recommendation, it was published, gave an RFD, or a reference dosage, of 0.0007 milligrams per kilogram per day. I've given a summary of the source of these findings, and they're available online at the URL at the bottom of the slide. Now, the important thing to remember here is that this RFD is based on a biochemical precursor effect and not a carcinogenic endpoint. Going to the next slide. Now, DWEL, or drink of water equivalent level, is not a regulatory level. EPA has posted this reference dosage on their integral risk information system, and this reference dose that we talked about previously equates to a drinking water equivalency level calculation of 24.5 parts per billion. which is rather far above a lot of the state recommended action levels or MCLs that have been generated recently. Now, humans may also be exposed to perchlorate by ingestion from sources other than public drinking water supply. These alternative exposure routes include lettuce, other leafy vegetables, human and dairy milk, and bottled water. If there is exposure to perchlorate from sources other than water, then the daily allowable amount in drinking water needs to be reduced to some concentration lower than the drinking water equivalency level, or DWEL, of 24.5 parts per billion. I've gave you the Integrated Risk Information System website here if you'd like to look up the information as well in the slide. Moving on to slide number 43. For the current regulatory status, EPA utilizes a three-step approach to developing an MCL. Levels for all contaminants. The first step is to determine the levels of human health concern. EPA has done this by publishing the National Research Council reference dosage in the IRIS, but has not promulgated an MCL to date. The second is to determine the parameter if interest can be reliably detected and quantified in the environment. EPA's Office of Research and Development has developed several low-level methods that we talked about earlier. And the third step in the process is determination of best available treatment technologies. We're about to discuss this topic in the next presentation made by Tony Lieberman after the question and answer period. Now, the California Developmental and Reproductive Toxicant DART Identification Committee is a panel of independent scientists. This committee, which is administered by the California Environmental Protection Agency Office of Health Hazard Assessment, has concluded that the available scientific information on perchlorate was not sufficient for placing the substance on the Proposition 65 list. Going to the next slide, number 44, some states have adopted advisory levels for perchlorate in drinking water, while a few are considering or in the process of promulgating state levels in lieu of a federal standard. Although states evaluate the same toxicological data used by the EPA and the National Academy of Sciences to determine an RFD of 0.007 milligrams per kilogram per day, they may evaluate that information differently, by different uncertainty factors, or consider relative source contributions differently. States as well as the federal EPA may also consider site-specific risk-based cleanup standards, such as the Superfund Record of Decision, ROD. As an example of this is the Aerojet facility in Rancho Cordova, California. Additionally, based on EPA's acceptance of the National Academy of Science January 5th report, identifying 24.5 parts per billion as drinking water equivalent level for perchlorate, the U.S. Department of Defense issued its January 2606 perchlorate policy, and this policy establishes 24 parts per billion as the current level of concern for managing perchlorate across DOD, and that it will comply with the level of concern or any more stringent applicable state or federal promulgated standards once it's established. DOD is willing to discuss necessary cleanups under the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, CERCLA, when a site-specific risk assessment demonstrates risk to human health exists. A link to the policy on DOD required action related to perchlorate is available from the U.S. EPA Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Perchlorate Links page, and that URL can be given to you upon request. Moving on to slide number 45, risk management involves the evaluation of several different factors to decide how best to eliminate or minimize risks due to contaminants at a site. Now, traditional risk assessment involves the implementation and remedial activities that reduce contaminant concentrations to an acceptable risk-based level that are established during a risk assessment. Other measures may be taken to prevent completion of exposure. Or the best strategy for your site may involve a combination of these approaches. Because of site-specific and location-specific factors, risk management strategies may not be consistently applied across site and programmatic boundaries. After the QA break, Tony Lieberman is going to discuss various innovative systems that can be used in diverse risk management strategies. And I thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Lee. We're on slide 46, and we're going to take a break now for questions. For our simulcast participants, it's that orange question mark button at the top of the screen that will allow you to send in your questions. For our phone line audience, you are welcome to ask your own questions out loud. Remember to unmute your phone. If you've used our system, it is *7 to unmute. And also state your name, location, and, if appropriate, a slide number when you ask your question. Do you have a question from our phone line audience?
Yeah, this is Dan McCaffrey in Montana with EnviroCon.
Yes, Dan.
My question has to do with indoor air concentrations of perchlorate. And the confusion that we're seeing up here in Montana on a Superfund site, it's being managed under state Superfund, is indoor air concentrations in a commercial industrial building. And the confusion really boils down to the EPA's recommended levels. I think they came out with something in the past year and a half. Versus OSHA and, you know, their control over occupational exposures. All right, is anybody there familiar with that issue?
I'm familiar with perchlorate's properties, and it has no vapor pressure. Therefore, it cannot be considered under that subject heading you just mentioned. There is, of course, another way to ingest it, and that is if it's in some way a portion of dust. I would consider that a remote possibility, an unusual one for a vapor intrusion.
Okay. Well, thank you.
John Lipchak from New Hampshire.
Yes, John.
Hi. Two questions. One is the perchlorate that's discussed about the leafy vegetables, is that found on the outside or of the plant or on the inside, or is it in the root zone, or where is it located?
This is Eric. I'll jump in on that, Lee, and then you can follow up. Basically, it's found in the leaves in general. It's not only the vegetables, but leafy trees that are in the desert where the evaporation occurs. So it's usually where the evaporation occurs. So the chlorate is transported through the roots, up through the stems, and so on, and concentrates in the leafy area. So in the case of lettuce, obviously, it's almost all leaf. Obviously, it's pretty widely distributed. But in general, if you look at the mechanism, it's an evaporation process and concentration.
Yeah, this is Lee here. We discussed that in detail, the uptake of perchlorate in our new TechReg document. We do have a phyto and riser remediation section in our TechReg treatment document. It's going out now for DOD review, second DOD review, and then it goes to Battelle for the publication. But in addition to that, one of the complicating factors is that in the rhizozone down in the roots, there has been some research that indicates that some of the perchlorate, not all of it, undergoes reduction with the ambient bacteria that are in the root zone. But Eric's completely right in what he said, that typically it's transported up to the leaf.
Okay, thank you. The follow-up question is, I've been doing some reading before perchlorate, you know, was a constituent or is a constituent of black powder, and how prevalent have the instructors, researchers seen evidence of perchlorate in surface water or groundwater given its high solubility in outdoor shooting ranges?
Let's see, I'll jump in on that. I think that it's too transportable and soluble. It needs accumulation situations where you have a fairly high concentration.
For example,
you're from Montana, and the cases, or somebody was anyway, where you have explosives. If you have a portion of them and they use explosives by the pounds, you don't see some of that material actually exploding. It simply sits there unexploded and then will leach, but it represents a concentrated source.
Right.
In a shooting range situation, you don't quite have the same situation where it's used in munitions and so on. If they're actually exploded, most of it is pretty efficient and gets used. It's where you either have hog out, where munitions are washed out, and there it's prevalent, where you have not used or chemically reacted, I guess is the way to say it, the perchlorate. If it chemically reacts, fires, whatever, most of the perchlorate, if not all, is gone, consumed, chemically destroyed.
When it's used with black powder?
Well, when it's used, I was giving you in general with any of the explosives, but black powder would probably follow that model.
Okay, thank you.
I have a simulcast question from Alan Bobbitt at USR in Santa Ana, California. Is there any use of perchlorate in the oil and gas industry?
Man, that's a challenge. Not to my knowledge that I've seen, though I know they do some explosive fracturing, et cetera. So anywhere following this model where explosives are used and not completely exploded, as we just discussed, you have that potential. I'm trying to scratch my head and think of other applications in the oil and gas industry.
Wastewater treatment, Eric, we're seeing.
Yeah, I guess.
We're using bleach. It has been found to be a component of commercial bleach, and there's evidence, at least in a study that was conducted in Massachusetts, that bleach that sits on the shelf can produce more. It, for some reason or other, some of it converts to perchlorate, but that's the only instance that I can think of.
Yeah, it hasn't come up on our radar as one of the industries that has commonly used, produced, handled, et cetera, perchlorate.
A simulcast question from John Quinn at Argonne National Laboratory in Illinois. Is there a field analytical method or a sensor available for perchlorate analysis of water?
I can jump into that a little bit, and then Lee can take it. There is ion selective probes, and those have been calibrated and used. We've used them successfully in the field. They don't have nearly the detection low-end limits that Lee so nicely described with the laboratory analytical, nor do they stay calibrated necessarily very long. But basically, under ion selective probes, you'll see some manufacturing of units for field application, and we've used them in the field, and they if calibrated, they indeed work.
This is Tony. There's some there's also some immunoassays that are being developed which could work in the field, which would have lower detection limits, but they're not readily available.
John Lipchak from New Hampshire again.
Yes, John.
The use of perchlorate in, say, blasting operations and related to, like, ammonium nitrate in diesel fuel, they use that in blasting, especially in New Hampshire, to put down a borehole to blast rock for a road. Is perchlorate often found in connection with, it comes from the same mineral, I'm assuming from my limited reading on it, the nitrate ore.
Yeah, I can.
Well, nitrate can be produced naturally, but it's also produced commercially as well, and you wouldn't have perchlorate in the industrial manufactured.
In the, at least historic explosives manufacturing that I'm familiar with, and it's not an infinite number of sites, but it's several. And even today, the nitrate that they receive is has small concentrations or low concentrations of perchlorate. So, you know, it's a matter of price, and you get some contamination of perchlorate.
So you're saying that there's really not much the composition of perchlorate with ammonium nitrate is next to nil, so it doesn't have any effect on the groundwater? Or?
Well, the problem is the part per billion MCL, or limits. And so a little bit of perchlorate goes a long ways when you're talking about large concentrations, I mean large quantities. You're handling in explosives manufacturing sizable quantities, you know, maybe even tons.
Right.
Yeah, but they're not using, it's not referring to the use of explosives, as you talked about, ammonium nitrate with diesel. Was it New Hampshire?
Correct.
And the perchlorate is the, you know, a violent oxidizer, but it's normally associated with, you know, the fireworks and that sort of thing, rather than the mixtures that I'm familiar with anyway.
Yeah, well, Lee here, I think that in part of the preparation of one of our proposals to ITRC, we talked about best management practices. And if I'm correct, you can go to the Massachusetts DEP website, and I believe they do have the best available best management practices for the use of explosives for throughways and roads there. It won't be specific like Ian and Eric and Tony have mentioned, because typically the problem sites are quantity related, and when you take the explosives out to do the roadway work, you're not dealing with the quantities, and most of them are consumed during the process.
But I recall that Rose Knox, who's from Massachusetts DEP, talked about some case histories in Massachusetts where road, you know, where blasting for road expansion was shown to result in perchlorate contamination in some nearby residential wells.
Right.
So there may be something for this.
That's true, and that's why the state was one of two. Actually, California also developed BMPs as well. You know, and that's for like unexploded situations, because the MCL is down so low in the part per billion range. You know, small quantities can have a large effect, and that's why they developed the BMPs for the road explosive work and for fireworks areas and demonstrations.
I asked that question because we have a new site where several drinking water wells have been affected by nitrate from a blasting in the development by the contractor, and the initial report back is that their way of they weren't following any best management practices. I'm fairly certain the way they were employing the ammonium nitrate and sticking the charge in and so forth. But I guess it wouldn't be safe to make sure you sample for perchlorate. We don't have any MCL in DES in New Hampshire, but I imagine in a situation like that, we ought to be sampling for perchlorate.
That might be a good idea.
Well, sometimes it's added in significant quantities to the explosives because it gives it a serious increase in energetics. So it depends on exactly the formulation that they were using.
I was reading how it gives it a much more bang for its buck, so to speak.
Right, and they do that. The manufacturers sell the explosive both ways. And when you need more bang for the bucks, if you will, than that perchlorate's actually added. And there, it's not in trace amounts, it's in significant amounts.
This is Julianne. I do want to get to our last two simulcast questions.
Thank you.
Thanks, John. From Stephen Morris from Salem, New Hampshire, do the proposed MCLs concern the total natural occurring perchlorate and man-made perchlorate, or can naturally occurring be subtracted from the total?
Well, this is Lee here. If you look at the reference journal articles that we have in the overview document, a lot of the research, and one of our members, Paul Hatzinger and the USGS, have been looking into the isotope methods for the characterization of naturally occurring perchlorate. You'll see that it's not exactly straightforward where your instrumentation spits out a known concentration of naturally occurring perchlorate versus synthetic perchlorate. Actually, what they have to do is take a look at cluster analysis of individual oxygen and chloride isotopes to see how they cluster to determine the relative contribution from naturally occurring sources versus synthetic sources. The Chilean nitrate has a characteristic isotope signature versus synthetic sources. And that's the best answer I can give to you. So presently, I don't believe it's calculated as a component. It would be included and detected in the analytical methods, the ICP-MS and the tandem mass spectrometry, as total perchlorate. It would still be detected that way by mass, but to actually apportion how much is synthetic versus naturally occurring is still a complicated task.
Thank you. And one last question for this break from Patrick Nordz at NTH Consultants in Cleveland, Ohio. How is USDA or FDA addressing the disparity between the PBB parts per billion action levels and the parts per million levels in produce?
Well, again, that's Lee here. That's part of the complicated assessment, exposure pathway assessment, that's still up for debate. You'll see that California recently adopted an MCL of 6. In New Jersey, we have recommendations around 5. And we had considered alternative and secondary routes of exposure in calculating those numbers, because you can see that they're significantly less than the drinking water equivalency level of 24 parts per billion. The FDA typically comes out with safe levels that are rather high thresholds in the parts per million because of ambient levels in the vegetation, but the EPA really hasn't settled on they really haven't settled the relative source contribution from vegetables and other sources.
My understanding, Lee, is that there are studies that are ongoing, basically look at what the uptake is in people from their vegetable sources versus their drinking water, milk, what have you. So, you know, it needs to be an integrated total for chlorate, and they're trying to decide at different or get the data for different locations in the country what the relative contributions would be. So it's an ongoing investigation, and they are looking at the different uptakes, you know, whether it's your vegetable uptakes like we talked about with lettuce, whether it's your drinking water or possibly milk or some other source. And it's the integrated total of those that they're going to have to get data on and be concerned about.
Thank you, instructors. We need to wrap up this question and answer break. We will have more time at the end of the presentation for more questions. If everyone who has taken their phone off mute, please put your phone back on mute. And if you're using our system, it is *6 to mute the phone. And I'll remind you at the next break, *7 will unmute so you can ask more questions. On slide 47, I will turn today's presentation over to Tony Lieberman at Solutions IES. Tony?
Yes, Juliana, can you hear me?
Yes.
Good, okay. Well, thank you to everybody for your attention to the first half of the presentation and those good questions that we just hopefully addressed for you. In the second half of the presentation today, I'm going to shift gears a little bit and talk about remediation. And the interesting thing is, obviously, there's a lot of concern about perchlorate and a lot of information that's growing about the extent of the contamination. But the good news is that there are effective approaches for remediating perchlorate, and new approaches are under study all the time. So we're going to focus on the remediation technologies that are available and are being used in this portion of the presentation. So on slide 47, one of the first things we need to consider as we approach a perchlorate situation is, first of all, where is the perchlorate? Is it in the soil? Is it in groundwater, surface water, drinking water, wastewater? These are the questions that are, you know, obviously the most important question right off the bat. The second thing is to consider, you know, how accessible is it? Is it really deep or is it shallow? You know, that can drive what options you might want to consider. And then the second major remediation consideration is, what's the objective of the remediation? We just what's the goal, the regulatory goal? That's actually what comes on the next slide, but what's the objective of the remediation? Is it to protect or treat a drinking water supply? Or are we simply trying to treat the source or control the plume? If we move forward to slide number 48, you can see what I just alluded to, and another consideration, of course, is the regulatory goal, and we've already had some discussion about that, and it varies from state to state. And the goals, how aggressive you are with approaching the remediation can be determined by the goal and, of course, by the timing. And the type of approach you take can be driven by the discharge limits for the technology you've selected, perhaps. And, of course, a final thing to consider is, what is the prevailing geology or the hydrogeology, because that can be a determining factor in whether you use an in-situ or ex-situ treatment approach, of which there are several in both categories. Let's move forward to the next slide, number 49. Focus down a little more closely on the factors in selecting the technology that you might want to choose, and how that impacts the success of the technology. These two slides, 49 and 50, actually have four different factors highlighted. And the first one of these is the perchlorate concentration. And as you might expect, the choice of the technology is somewhat dependent on the relative starting concentration. For example, the technology of choice for treating a public drinking water supply that contains only 1 to 10 micrograms per liter might be very different from the treatment approach for a groundwater plume that contains 5 to 10 milligrams per liter. So the concentration, of course, will help, is an important factor in determining which technology to use. The second factor, the second bullet there, is the scale of the treatment that's needed. And so the scale, the magnitude, the extent of the problem, is obviously important to understand. A small, defined groundwater plume that is clearly delineated already may be treated in its entirety using one of several in-situ approaches, but a mile-long, mile-wide plume threatening a drinking water reservoir may lend itself to a different technology entirely, something that perhaps intercepts further plume spread or simply provides hydraulic control. The third factor is the water quality parameters, and that's a combination of a number of sub-factors, I guess, these are sub-parameters that are listed there. And, for example, biological approaches for treating perchlorate can be sensitive to water quality extremes, such as low pH or high dissolved oxygen or high redox potential and elevated metals. And biological systems can be sensitive maybe more so than non-biological systems, but that doesn't mean that non-biological systems don't have their sensitivities, and for example, non-biological systems can be more sensitive to some conditions, including high dissolved solids. So understanding the water quality parameters is very important in determining what techniques that you might want to approach or might want to think about using. Moving forward to slide number 50, we show the fourth factor that is of some consideration, and that is the presence and contamination of co-contaminants. Co-contaminants are not usually a problem in a drinking water situation, but on commercial and military installations, perchlorate is frequently found commingled with other chlorinated solvents, for example, PCE, TCE, and TCA. Maybe some petroleum solvents, such as BTEX, and sometimes even some explosives like RDX and HMX and TNT. And obviously that complicates what approach you might take for that particular remediation. Now, the interesting thing is there are a number of populations of organisms that can degrade perchlorate, but in a co-contaminant situation, you're talking about different microbial populations that can also metabolize the other co-contaminants, and they may metabolize those at different degradation rates. So it's not one size fits all. The other thing that's interesting is that sometimes the co-contaminant can actually be a benefit. We'll talk later about the use of donors, electron donors and substrates to promote perchlorate degradation. Well, sometimes some situations you have co-contaminants like BTEX, for example, that can provide some of that electron donor capacity and promote biodegradation. Now, when it comes to abiotic systems, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit, different contaminants may have different affinities for ion exchange resins or carbon sites, and that may cause interference with the treatment of perchlorate. So that has to be taken into consideration. So wherever possible, these interactions should be evaluated in lab microcosms and bench tests or field pilot tests before committing to a full-scale implementation. Now, that's all we're really going to say about co-contaminants here in this particular overview training. There's going to be more detail. There is more detailed discussion of the impact of co-contaminants in the upcoming tech reg document that Lee alluded to earlier that's scheduled for publication early this spring, I believe. So if you need more information about that, that's where you might want to go after that comes out. Okay, let's move forward to slide number 51. As an overview, before we get into the details of the technologies, I wanted to say that the overview document that we're referring to today in the training does provide summaries with some details of the proven and commercially available technologies that are currently being employed. In fact, Appendix F of that document contains a matrix that summarizes different projects that are actively treating perchlorate. Now, some projects employing emerging technologies are also described in that matrix. Now, since that's been published in 2005, there's been continuing work, and so I would also encourage the listeners to look for the publication of the new document in the spring, which may have more information. But regardless, the applicability matrix does provide patients, summarizes site conditions, identifies the technology that's being used, and offers a summary of the progress to date. And ITRC does not endorse any particular products or vendors, I think as Juliana said early on, but the reader can use the matrix to identify consultants or vendors or practitioners and products that are currently involved in perchlorate cleanups. So if you're interested in technologies and finding out who's doing it, that would be a good place to start. Let's move forward to slide number 52 and get into more of the details of what's available. As I said earlier, there are commercially available technologies out there, and they pretty much can get broken down into two categories, the physical and chemical technologies and the biological technology. Anion exchange, under the physical and chemical technologies, we're talking about ex situ technologies, where, in fact, groundwater is brought up to the surface and treated in some above-ground treatment. And that is primarily ion exchange at this time. Now, on the biological processes, the approaches are a little more varied. There are both ex situ and in situ technologies. And the interesting thing about biological processes and the things that makes it so powerful is that the perchlorate-reducing bacteria appear to be very widespread in the environment. So with just a little bit of tweaking and knowing what you're doing, you can effectively promote the desired enhanced bioremediation of perchlorate. Let's move forward to slide number 53 and start the discussion of the physical processes, and in particular, ion exchange reaction mechanisms, as I said, is the most widely used of the physical chemical processes. It's essentially, as shown here on the slide, an equilibrium process. You can see the equation at the bottom of the slide where perchlorate anion is exchanged with another anion, which is typically chloride. And the resins that are used can be made from natural or synthetic organic, inorganic, or polymeric material that contains a functional ionic group. A typical ion exchange system consists of small resin beads that form a resin bed in a large cylindrical vessel that contains millions and millions of the beads. There are a number of full-scale treatment systems in use, treating contaminated groundwater for remediation and also for some drinking water situations in California and some other states. The Basically, as it shows there in the third bullet, the medium consists of an ion exchange resin, as I said, containing a positively charged functional group, that's the R4N+, with a strong affinity to the perchlorate ion. And very straightforward. Now, this is an area of, it's very straightforward, but it can be relatively expensive. And this is an area of continuing research, and there's continuous focus on new, less costly, more selective resins. There's some bifunctional anion exchange resins that are coming out that are very highly selective for perchlorate. And but this is an area of a lot of research and a lot of developmental work, and the costs are coming down. Let me see. Number 54. This slide is a schematic that covers the two options that are currently being employed for ion exchange. The bottom line is, in either case, the contaminated water is pumped to the treatment system. So you see the influent going through a particle filter on the left-hand side, and it enters the ion exchange bed, which is the IX cycle on this schematic. And then the treated water, after the perchlorate is removed, is then discharged. Now, the differences in the commercially available options are related to how the resin is handled. In option one, which is in the upper right-hand quadrant of the schematic, it shows a regenerable system in which the resin is cleaned and reused multiple times. And the steps that are involved in that are essentially threefold. First is the adsorption and loading step, where the contaminated water is pumped through the system where the exchange takes place. And in that particular system, the rate of absorption depends on many factors. It can, for example, the resin selectivity, the perchlorate concentration, any competing ions in the waste stream, the flow, the size of the resin beads, and diffusion within the porous structure of the beads. And that's where your engineering design comes in, and I know that the manufacturers and the suppliers of those resins are fully available to help you with sizing your systems. The second step is regeneration, where a regenerant brine solution is used to displace the concentrated contaminant ion, that's the perchlorate, that had been adsorbed to the exchange resin. And then the final step is the rinse cycle, where the regenerant solution is rinsed from the exchange resin before the next exchange cycle. And the more you can rinse the resin, the longer the resin is the lifespan of the resin is extended. So that's what they mean by a regenerative or regenerable ion exchange system. Now, the second option is shown in the lower right-hand quadrant of the schematic, and in that option, the resin is disposed of right after it's used. And so you use the resin one time, and after the resin sites reach saturation, the resin's removed and replaced with new material and then the spent resin is disposed of in a landfill by fuel blending or incineration, some other means of disposal. So they each are effective. They're each used widely. They each have costs and design features associated with them that you need to keep in mind. But it is very commonly used for treating, in particular, groundwater contaminated with perchlorate. Slide number 55 shows sort of the size, gives you a scale of an appearance of a large-scale ion exchange system, the number of the resin beds on a carousel, and slide number 56 lists the advantages and disadvantages of ion exchange systems. You can see them there. The advantages are very, very strong. You can treat down to very low levels, less than the 4 parts per billion. Very fast reaction times, as with any, most chemical remediations, that's what you're looking for, is fast reaction times, so you can deal with higher flows. It is well accepted by the regulatory community, and as I indicated earlier, there's continuing research to help reduce costs. Now, the disadvantages are shown as well. The resin can be sensitive to incoming water chemistry and to high suspended solids, which can clog the resin bed. There may be some competitive uptake by other anions, and you do have to do something with the waste water or the waste brine that contains the high perchlorate contamination. There's a cost associated with that. But overall, widely used and well-respected, and it's something to consider for remediation sites. Slide number 57. We're going to shift gears now and move on to the biological processes. And we've got this essentially a few bullets here. And I said earlier that one of the nice things about the biological processes is there's a lot of perchlorate reducing bacteria that have been identified in the environment, for example, TCE, where you're pretty much, looking at the Halobacter, the Halococcoides. If those aren't there, it's not going to happen. There's a variety of perchlorate-reducing bacteria that have been isolated. The interesting thing is, despite the fact that there's all these bacteria in the environment, perchlorate does tend to persist. And typically, one of the major factors there is because a lot of aquifers are aerobic, and a lot of these bacteria are anaerobes or facultative anaerobes, and their enzymes can only function in low oxygen tension environments. The illustration there, that little funny looking bacteria there with both the tail and the legs, the flagella and the cilia, that's sort of a little cartoon of a multiple type of bacteria. I don't think any bacteria actually look that way. But it shows the degradation of perchlorate, the ClO4, to chlorate, which is the ClO3, and then chlorite, ClO2, and ultimately to chloride and oxygen, and those are enzymatic steps. And the rate-limiting step is the degradation of perchlorate to chlorate. That's the first two steps, or the first step. And there's a perchlorate reductase enzyme that then catalyzes the reduction of chlorate to chlorite. And then there's a chlorite dismutase enzyme, which has been shown to be specific for breaking down chlorite to chloride and oxygen. And that's something that's been studied quite a bit, that chlorite dismutase enzyme, because it can show, if you can measure it in the field or from field samples, you can pretty much use it as an indicator of bioactivity on perchlorate. It's an interesting enzyme that's being used diagnostically and in remediation settings. Now, one other thing is a variety of electron donors and substrates have been shown to promote biological reduction of perchlorate. I mentioned that earlier. And some of those include lactate, acetate, some, you know, ethanol, vegetable oils, any kind of some sugars, anything that you can get in the ground that can become an electron donor, can be degraded, fermented to generate hydrogen as it'll become an electron donor, can be shown to promote biological reduction of perchlorate. Move forward to the next slide, which is number 58. Okay, now that we have a general understanding that there are bugs out there and that they how they function, I'm going to talk about a number of approaches for ex situ bioremediation, and then I'm going to pass the baton to Ian Oscarby, and he's going to finish off the presentation talking about in situ bioremediation. When we talk about ex situ bioremediation, we're talking about pumping groundwater or whatever water stream that we're dealing with, whatever aqueous waste stream we're dealing with, through above-ground treatment tanks of some design. And there are three designs that are typically used, some more than others, and those are shown here, the continuous flow stirred tank reactor, fluidized bed reactors, and packed reactors. Move to number 59. On slide number 59, we show a schematic of a typical ex situ bioremediation treatment process, some ways similar to what we showed for the ion exchange system. Essentially, the influent comes in on the left, goes through an equalization tank that helps the bioreactor perform at its optimum design capacity, where you have high concentrations of perchlorate coming in. There's often a need to add some electron donors, such as ethanol or acetate, something that's soluble, can be dripped into the bioreactor. And then the treated water is essentially discharged, ready for discharge, with absent of perchlorate. Now, if you're going to just be able to discharge that water back to some sort of receiving stream, then there may not be any need to do the extra steps that are shown on the right-hand side of the slide after the word treated. Those steps are the steps that represent additional treatment should you want to perhaps take your treated effluent and process it in anticipation of using it for drinking water. So that's why you've got the final UV disinfection step before you've got the effluent. But at any rate, it's pretty straightforward, and all the real activity is taking place in the bioreactor. The next slide, which is number 60, shows a little more detail about continuous flow stirred tank reactors, and these are basically suspended growth reactors within continuous influent effluent flow, and they're most commonly used in for wastewater, industrial wastewaters, and they're generally best suited for low flow, high strength waste systems because you can control the contact time very effectively. You just get a continuous mixing, as illustrated by the veins, or it's created by the veins that are shown on the shaft in the middle of the tank. The next slide waiting for mine to come up here. Number 61 is basically shows a fluidized bed reactor, and that's the same general principle, but you use a sand or granular activated carbon matrix or solid medium. It's a solid, something that the bugs can grab onto, but it's fluidized in that large tank to promote high microbial densities in the tank. And the nice thing about this design is that it's applicable for a wide range of concentrations, and has a lot of flexibility because the bacteria tend to adhere and stay in the tank more so than the continuous stir reactor. And so you can get co-contaminants such as nitrate also treated at the same time. The next slide, number 62, just shows a large-scale fluidized bed reactor system in Henderson, Nevada, just for scale purposes. Next slide, number 63, talks about the last of the three designs, and that's a fixed film or packed bed reactor, which is a lot like you might see at a trickling filter at a wastewater treatment plant, where you use a solid media in the tank to disperse the biodegradative organisms. And it's not used as frequently, but the design can be used effectively to remove perchlorate if needed. So now, I'm going to move forward to slide number 64 and let Ian Oscoby from Massachusetts finish off with his discussion of in-situ bioremediation. Ian?
Thank you, Tony. I moved to slide 64. We're running somewhat behind time, so I'll try and get things back on schedule as best I can without losing too much of the information. In-situ bioremediation will be discussed in the next few slides. It can be applied to the saturated zone below the water table, generally. It has been done in the Vado zone, but generally it's been in water table because generally you're adding things to the water. You need perchlorate-reducing bacteria, and it can often be stimulated to degrade perchlorate to below detection. And this is accomplished pretty much like Tony said, by adding a microbial growth substrate, basically food for the bugs to live on, the acetate, ethanol, molasses. A number of things have been tried, and they work both ex situ and in situ. And there are two general strategies for groundwater treatment: permeable reactive barriers and mobile soluble amendments. Next slide, please. Permeable reactive barriers. These could be the bio barriers. You see one on the right actually being constructed. They can be very large. They're not limited to short ones. And on the lower left, there's a cartoon that shows basically a permeable barrier that's placed in the path for the contaminant, which is shown in the somewhat darker plume, which will then pass through the barrier, be treated by the bugs, or and the perchlorate reduced. Solid substrates are placed in trenches, or low viscosity amendments are injected, because they're going to travel with the water if they're injected into it. Water flows through and past the fixed treatment zone. And both of these are instances of fixed treatment zones. Slide 66. Mobile amendments. You can inject water-soluble or miscible amendments with low viscosity into an upgrading portion, as shown on the left, portion of the plume or source area. And these are going to travel with the groundwater towards an observation well, which presumably hopefully has been placed in such a position that you can determine that the plume length was sufficient and the bugs active enough to accomplish the remediation. On other situations, as shown on the right, a more active system rather than the passive on the left is one in which, again, you deliver the amendments into the plume. They travel with the plume towards an extraction well. And the extraction well then extracts, more electron donor is added to it, and then it's re-injected. And it's a continuous closed loop. The monitoring well indicates how well you're doing with this. And once the contaminants have been removed and reacted or eaten by the bugs, you then consult with the regulators to see if you can terminate your project. On the left, we're showing an inject and drift. It's a passive, basically a more passive system, and then on the right, an active system where the two contaminants and the injected donor and any nutrients that need to be applied can be done in a more continuous manner. So let's go to slide 67. Some examples of in-situ bioremediation amendments for the fixed barriers, bark mulch, soybean oil, which is a much more viscous material, and again a controlled viscosity of the emulsified soybean oil, which basically has a controlled rate of consumption and travel for the electron donors, the soybean oil, basically the food. And chitin is another alternative, and others have been proposed and used, but they will form this sort of system. In mobile amendments, are much more soluble, low viscosity, and they are going to basically travel with the injected into the plume. So lactate or a polymerized lactate, molasses, ethanol, and acetate. And the polymerized lactate might have viscosity somewhat more controlled than with the others, but it's basically the same principle. You either have a fixed a carbon source in the permeable reactive barrier and the plume flows through it, or you have an amendment which is added to the plume and then it just travels. And it may be a passive or an active system as just previously described. So let's go to slide 68. Now, what kind of amendment injection approaches do we try? Well, they're standard. As shown on the upper left, they can be injected into a well that might be a permanent well with a well screen, and the equipment on at the upper surface, a supply of your nutrient or chemical, whatever you want to call it, and that's generally diluted with water, and both the donor and nutrients can be added and then pumped into, or could it be gravity, could go with gravity flow, but generally would be pumped into this, into the injection well and distributed into the plume through an injection well screen at some depth. And on the right hand side, we have a more mobile setup using a direct push system, and this can be moved around, or you can in fact leave a probe there. But generally, it would move around, and you could inject this in a number of locations. And these are they're basically the same, except that one is a more portable system, and the other is a more permanent system. But they're, as I said, they're essentially the same process. Let's move to slide 69. Soil bioremediation. We have in-situ soil bioremediation, where a carbon source is added as a biological substrate. It has been tested at several sites with near-surface contamination. And ex-situ bioremediation, that Tony described, where carbon sources, water, and in some cases bulking agents are blended. And these would be in piles, for instance. There have been some large-scale demonstrations conducted. One in McGregor, Naval Weapons Industrial Reserve Plant, I believe Aerojet has another one, and there are probably quite a few more. And these are capable of reaching quite low perchlorate levels. Now let's go to slide 70, the next slide. We have emerging processes. These for bioremediation, as on the left-hand side, vapor phase electron donor injection. By emerging, I mean these are not commercially practiced, or generally not commercially practiced yet. They're being developed. ESTCP might be exploring this, and other research phases, and some of them conducted by APSI and DOD, etc. Membrane bioreactors, again, Tony discussed some of this, and there's a lot of development work going on. only to natural attenuation and final remediation. There's work still continuing with this. And final remediation, believe it or not, has been demonstrated to reach as low as 2 ppb in the subsurface. So there are difficulties associated with doing this, but it is possible, and you can reach a low target concentration. And constructive wetlands, of course, are natural. They're generally quite anaerobic in practice. And the strongly anaerobic conditions are generally very conducive to reducing things like perchlorate, in addition to any other solvents, et cetera, that we're familiar with, like the chlorinated solvents. But perchlorate also requires strongly reducing conditions, not as strong as for the chlorinated solvents, but they're wetlands are a good source for that. There's additional information that you can get from ITRC on a number of their committees. They're developing various technologies on enhanced attenuation, et cetera, as well as the perchlorate. There are many physical and chemical processes that are being developed, nanoscale biometallic particles, titanium chemical reduction, zero valent reduction under UV light, well, familiar with the iron, zero valent iron reductions, and there are others. There are electrochemical reduction processes, capacitive deionization, reverse osmosis, electrodialysis, nanofiltration, ultrafiltration, catalytic gas membranes, and even thermal treatment, believe it or not, has been demonstrated to be capable of taking perchlorate in soils down to as low to less than 1 ppb. Now, typically, if doing a thermal treatment, you would be looking at these, of course, are ex situ. You're not going to do thermal treatment in the ground. And the primary reason for that is that ammonium perchlorate requires something like 750 degrees Fahrenheit to cause it to thermally degrade. In a treatment process, it was required to get up around 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit on wet soils at, on Cape Cod, the MMR range, in order to get the perchlorate in the soils down to below 1 ppb. And they treated somewhere around, it's either 60 or 100,000 tons of soil and reached that 1 ppb. We've also done other work with absorption systems. We've evaluated the water at, on Cape Cod is very near perfect for this kind of evaluation. It has virtually no other anions. It's anion free except for the perchlorate, unfortunately. But it does allow you to evaluate, and we did do this, carbon adsorption versus ion exchange without other competing anions that would cloud the issue. So we're just looking at taking out the perchlorate. And we did this successfully with many bed volumes for carbon, but eventually we were able to show that the ion exchange system was superior. We haven't shown it to be that much greater under the idealized water conditions at Cape Cod, but the ion exchange is now the clear winner, and that's all we're using now on the we have about 4 gram of treatment, 4 plumes that we're treating by this ion exchange. And we're also looking into the possibility of how to do reclamation of the ion exchange, which is actually being practiced in California. And there's a company developing on the East Coast and the West Coast a commercial practice where they bioremediate the ion exchange. It's offside, of course, from where it's contaminated, but this is a process that's being developed to get the cost of treating and get the cost of the ion exchange medium down. I guess we'll have to move on to the summary now, so that we have enough time for questions. Slide 71, please. In summary, the perchlorate is an emerging contaminant of concern. Increased monitoring, improved analytical methods, increased number of known sites, a vast increase in known sites throughout the country, long and persistent contaminant plumes when released into the ground or surface water because it's so solid, well, it travels with the groundwater and travels as fast as the groundwater, and drinking water has become the primary focus of concerns. 572. Sources, perchlorate is both naturally occurring and it is widely manufactured, Eric discussed. And knowing the sources of perchlorate and the variety of its uses helps guide the perchlorate investigations. Slide 73. Lee Lippincott told you much about the analytical methodologies, many, many slides on that. 314 used for monitoring drinking water as an unregulated contaminant, but there are several improved analytical methodologies to get you down consistently to the 2, 1, and as we discovered, 0.01 parts per billion. Slide 74. Toxicity, exposure, and risk. Perchlorate is one of several substances competitively interfere with iodide uptake. There's general agreement that fetal and neonatal neurodevelopment is the primary concern. No federal maximum contaminant levels, the MCL, for perchlorate, but EPA has set a reference dose, in particular, Massachusetts has an MMCL of 2 ppb, although the federal recommended was leaning towards 24.5 ppb, the actual number selected in Massachusetts was 2, and that was to also account for the ingested perchlorate from food, lettuce, and tomatoes, etc. Slide 75. Regulatory status, some states established their own health-based goals, Nevada 18, Texas 17, Arizona 14, California 6, New Jersey 5, Kansas 4, as I say, Massachusetts was 2. And there's a couple of URLs, websites that you can go to for more information. And, of course, the ITRC documents, the one that's coming, the RECTED, and the one that we've already had since 2005. Slide 76, remedial options. You've heard a fair amount from Tony and myself. There are remediation technologies. Some of them are commercially available. Many of them are in development and being practiced at pilot scale and will transition to full scale as more information and how well they behave. Most remediation technologies are focused more on treating drinking water, and a variety of considerations are involved in selecting a remediation technology, and a variety of emerging technologies, as I said in my last slide, are under development and study, and very actively and promoted by Environmental Science, EFTCP, Environmental Science Technology Certification Program. There's a new document coming out, the TechReg guidance, which will have more of case studies and more detailed information than was presented here and in the former document. And there will be a compendium of information, which is considerable at this stage. Thank you for participating. I'll turn it back over to Juliana.
Thank you, Ian. On slide 78, we do want to go to our links to additional resources before we get to our second question and answer period. So if you select the part of the slide that does read links to additional resources, we do include the URL under that, and that is because this is a resource that's going to continue to be available for you. Before we look at the links, I do want to point out on the left side, the third item down under that Clue and Sun is the feedback button. And we do appreciate your feedback, and as we've said throughout the presentation, the team is working on a new document and training so we can use the information that you provide and respond to that. So we would appreciate if you filled out the feedback form and gave us some information. Looking to the right, you can look over at those links. In section one, we have the first item will allow you to download the presentation from today's training class. In addition to what you've seen on the slides, more material is available in the speaker's notes section of that presentation. Today's training was based on the document Perchlorate, Overview of Issues, Status, and Remedial Options. That's the PERC-1 document. If you select that blue button, that's going to take you over to the ITRC website where you can download a PDF of that document if you haven't already. The Perchlorate team page is also available on the ITRC website. We've mentioned some other ITRC documents, and we've listed a few of those here in Section 1. so you're welcome to look at more information from ITRC. As you go down through the links page, we divided this similar to how we divided the presentation. So there's an introduction and background section, sources, uses, occurrences, and you're welcome to scroll down and look at what information is available if you are interested in more information about a specific section of the document. And as we said, the PCORATE team is working on a new document that will be out later this year, and that will be available on the ITRC website. We do now want to take time for questions. For our simulcast audience, again, it's the orange question mark at the top of the slides that allows you to send in questions. For our phone line audience, remember to unmute your phone. We ask that you say your name and location when you're asking a question. I would like to start from our simulcast audience. We did receive a question from Tim Mathin at URS in Sacramento, California. Tim, could you send in a new question that has a little bit more detail? I'm not quite sure how to ask the question that you sent in. From our phone line audience, would someone like to start with a question?
Yes, this is Dave Woodward with EarthTech.
Yes.
I have two questions. First one, they're somewhat related. Could someone comment on studies or experience on optimal redox conditions and microbial populations associated with varying redox conditions?
The general consensus is that the optimal redox condition is from 0 millivolts down to -100 millivolts. It does not, for perchlorate degradation, it doesn't have to be as deeply reducing as many people are familiar with chlorinated solvent degradation studies. So the optimal that is really considered is 0 to -100. Personally, I've seen, you know, +50, +60, you can still get good perchlorate degradation. In terms of populations, I don't know that there's a direct correlation between, or a direct relationship between what bugs will degrade perchlorate at different redox potentials. Obviously more facultative anaerobes, and I don't have the names for you right now. I can get them, but more facultative are going to be on the higher, more oxidative side of that range than the more strict anaerobes.
Appreciate that. My follow-up question is, I'm working at a site that has high concentrations in a fractured rock environment of commingled contaminants, chlorinated solvents, a number of nitroaromatics, including HMX, RDX, TNT, DNT, and perchlorate, and I'm curious if you're aware of any full-scale systems where the redox conditions were varied, essentially where you have maybe three different redox flow-through treatment zones where all three contaminants have been successfully treated under any lithologic environment, but specifically also fractured rock.
I've seen it done in, externally in a fluidized bed reactor. And typically all you need to do is get the reducing conditions, remove oxygen and nitrate, etc. And that, there were, depending on the bed contact time, we were able to successfully eliminate the RDX, HMX, and perchlorate. I've not seen it done with chlorinated solvents as well. But generally, we're not working down at such a low redox level. But again, I've not seen all chlorinated solvents also mixed in with the thing. Maybe someone else has. But you can certainly do the RDX, HMX, and perchlorate without too much trouble. But I've only seen it done externally.
Yeah, this is Eric. At Aerojet General, we did it with the horizontal flow wells, vertical wells. We did perchlorate nitrate first, and then we lowered it in situ to take care of the TCE. And that study was funded under ESTCP. And so it was a case where it was done sequentially. And again, basically, perchlorate reduces where nitrate does, and then, of course, TCE, you've got to go add more carbon and go to a much lower effective redox potential.
Eric, what was the scale of that, though? Would you call that a full scale or not?
It was about 60 feet wide, and I think the depth was approximately, on average, 180 feet deep.
What was the relative to the plume?
Well, that
a pilot scale or just a portion of it?
That particular methodology reached out 180 feet wide, and that covered much or most of the plume. There's been a couple of studies, one by GeoSyntec and one by the ESTCT study out there that was more recent, and it was clearly a demonstration, Ian, but it was what you'd call, because it was ESTCP, the near commercial size.
But you did that in two stages. You did the first reduction, it's not so intensive, to get down on the question is basis below the RDX and the chloride, and then seriously drove down the redox conditions to get to the chlorinated dissolvent requirements.
That was the way that it was chosen to be done. Yes.
This is Juliana. I have a simulcast question from Amy Rosenstein at ICF International in Lexington, Massachusetts. What have been some cleanup goals that you have seen at various sites?
Well, the ones that we have on Cape Cod are very low, less than 1 ppb of perchlorate. I think that's all I'm really familiar with, except in California. There are several that I've seen that there were at 6. And on that, I forget which slide it is, it showed you which states have different levels.
Yeah. For Henderson, Nevada, or the Nevada, their cleanup level has been for some time 18 ppb.
Thank you. Michael Woodruff at the Payne Firm in Cincinnati, Ohio, what range of soil cleanup goals may be expected to be protective of groundwater or food ingestion?
Say that again? What range of what?
Soil cleanup goals.
Soil.
May be expected to be protective of groundwater or food ingestion.
I think that's really site dependent, depending on recharge, vadose zone thickness, and so on. And I suspect that, you know, in the extreme, it would be, you know, a few parts per billion. But in a practical sense, that's probably not achievable, so it's some negotiated value higher than that. And I would guess, you know, it could be as high as 100 ppb or something like that.
I'm not sure that there are any standards for soil, are there, other than what was imposed at, on Cape Cod for the thermal desorption?
No, but there are sites, Ian, where they have to set it. It's not a standard, it's a...
Yeah, it's the saturated zone for which the standards are set.
Yeah.
A simulcast question from Tim Mathen at USR in Sacramento, California. During the training, concentrations of chloride had been described as low, medium, and high. Can you give ranges for those?
Well, that's the idea is to just represent relative concentrations. I mean, I think in the discussion I mentioned low being in the low part per billion range, like you might see in a large drinking water situation, or that we're seeing out in some of these areas where you're using irrigation water for agricultural crops, and that's in the low part per billion range. Medium, I guess, is anywhere higher than that, but not as high as you might see from a direct source like a hog-out facility, where they're actually cleaning out rocket motors that had perchlorate propellant in them, and you may be seeing, you know, 15, 10, 15, 20, 50 parts per million of, or even up to 100 parts per million of perchlorate in the groundwater. So, yeah, I mean, it is relative, but that's, I think that's, in terms of considering a remediation approach, those are kind of the ranges I was trying to get at.
Yeah, the extreme is like Henderson was
mm-hmm.
manufactured, and that's like 1,000 parts per million.
Right.
The ones that I'm familiar with that we evaluated on Cape Cod, below 100 ppb is the fluid bed reactors, etc., were not really deemed economical, cost competitive with absorption. So less than 100, I think, or significantly less, say 20 or below, I think you're looking strictly at absorption, the ion exchange or some others, like the ones that's being developed for making even carbon into a pseudo ion exchange by coating it with an ammonium salt so it becomes charged surface and works, but no longer, of course, works as an organic absorber. But those are fairly low. And we actually did evaluate the carbon ion exchange and the fluidized bed reactor, but our concentrations were typically just too low, at less than 100 to justify the expense of going to a fixed facility like a fluidized bed reactor.
Thank you. Do you have another question from our phone line audience?
Hey, a question from Canada. I'm
yes.
Karen McKendry from the Contaminated Sites Division at Health Canada. Two-part question relating to methods of analysis for perchlorate. Is there a preferred method of analysis for detecting perchlorate in soil samples?
Well, if you look at the SW846 methodology that are described, typically it's an extraction. And if you would send in your email address, I can ship you back the specifics of that.
Okay.
If you would like, that'd probably be the best way to do it.
Yeah.
Because I think I've got information on the FDA extraction procedure and the one that was used for SW846 as well.
Actually, Lee, I think some of the problems we ran into in Cape Cod, where we had lime added to it as a drying agent, gave us competing ions that led us away from the 314 to the other better defined techniques that you had discussed.
Yeah, that's true. And sometimes some of the methodologies that I've seen have added silicates too as well when the concentrations are extremely high. You have to deal with a lot of the difficulties with homogenization, especially if you have the binding agents with a lot of the munitions and other applications like that.
If you do send the email, I'll refer it over to the company that worked on this for us in Massachusetts.
Certainly can do that, yes.
Okay, I'll definitely send an email tomorrow.
Yeah.
The second part is I might have an opportunity to get some soil samples from our Geological Survey of Canada, which is similar to your USGS, and they, as procedure, freeze their samples. In looking at US EPA method 314.0, it suggests that you have to analyze the soil within 28 days. How important is that, and would these frozen soil samples possibly be samples that could be tested for perchlorate?
I think, I'm not sure how much microbial degradation or reduction processes take place with those. Tony, I don't know if you're still on the line, but
I'm here. I guess what I would, how I could possibly respond is, if I wouldn't think freezing would be a problem. Matter of fact, any way that you can keep the temperature low would reduce microbial activity. I think what typically with the preservation methods for perchlorate samples are a little bit different than you see for VOCs, for example. The idea with a perchlorate sample is to continue to maintain an aerobic environment, a headspace in the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
so that because under strictly aerobic conditions, you're not going to realize any further perchlorate degradation during the collection transport until it's analyzed. So from the sample collection perspective, sort of extrapolating what we do in water to what you might do with soil sample, I wouldn't think that if you had the sample collected, you didn't pack it too tightly in a container, there was no additional substrate in there, just purely the soil, and you froze it, I would think that when when the lab thaws it out and tries to extract it, I would think it'd be a pretty decently preserved sample.
As a matter of fact, it would be extremely difficult to get to the anaerobic conditions with all the material transfer operations and getting a sample preparation in order to make it even feasible for anaerobic reduction to occur, I would think.
Well, thank you to our instructors and to our audience today. We do need to wrap up. We've run a little bit over. So if you do have further questions, you're welcome to send those in. You can use slide 6 to send those directly to the instructors, or you can still send in simulcast questions, and we'll follow up with those. So thank you to our instructors and participants for joining us today. If you have not already, please fill out that feedback form. That is information we use, and we appreciate your taking the time to provide that to us. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website, www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again, and have a great day.